This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, Charles Drew Medical School files a $125 million lawsuit, and the federal government takes on the Walgreen company. Joining today's panel are political consultant Walter Fields, economist and author Julianne Malveaux, president and CEO of Last Word Productions. They're both in New York and right here with me in Washington, D.C. Ron Christie, vice president of the lobbying firm D.C. Navigators and former special assistant to President George W. Bush. So thanks for coming on, everybody. And let's go to King Drew. It's been a big story, especially in the African-American community. So when the troubled King Drew Medical Center was cut off from the Drew Medical School, some doctors say it was like losing an appendage. Officials at Charles R. Drew University of Medicine and Science say they're going to sue Los Angeles County for $125 million. They're claiming breach of contract from the county, which cut ties between the medical school and a struggling county hospital near Watts late last year. Julianne, this is a historically black institution. The hospital has been incredibly troubled, but you can't really have a medical school without an associated hospital. How should this play out?
Well, this is such a tragedy for Rye. Of course, King Drew Hospital was founded in the wake of the Watts uprisings, and its closing leaves the community in the same place it was with the Watts uprisings, having to go far away to get medical service. Of course, the LA Times has been on this story for a really long time, and there's more than enough blame to go around, but the way that the medical residents were treated at Drew University is something that we have to pay attention to, especially with the context of medical disparities in the African-American community, as well as the fact that Meharry, Morehouse, and Drew were training a disproportionate number of African-American doctors who have difficulty, for whatever reason, part of them discrimination, getting into other medical schools. So these residents needed to be transitioned in a much better way, and it doesn't seem to me that the county took that into consideration. Of course, let's be clear, the hospital, we don't even want to go into the list of challenges the hospital had, but the most recent challenge was that they lost $200 million in federal funding because they had 9 deficiencies out of 23. Notably, the treatment or the care from the medical school was not one of the deficiencies. I think that this $125 million lawsuit is an utter desperation move on the part of a university who's been constrained from what they can do with training because of the way folks have been treated. There could have been some transition move made so that some of these residents could have been trained, done their rotations at UCLA, USC, or other places. That was not done. So again, you know, while race is not the main issue here, race is a factor in the way young black doctors were being treated and the trajectory of their careers.
Now, Ron, this is the only historically black medical school west of the Mississippi. Is it really important to save it, or considering how bad the hospital has been in terms of its caregiving, is this just going to be a casualty?
My number one concern for Rye is to ensure that those residents, particularly in lower income areas such as Watts, have access to high quality medical care. My concern from looking at this complaint very briefly is that the hospital has failed a crucial part of their inspection. It was tied to $200 million worth of federal funds. And if you look at poor oversight in the radiology and the surgery departments, the federal government said that they were going to restrict funds if these standards were not met and they were not delivering the quality of care that was necessary to have an accreditation. So I'm very concerned. We must have access to high-quality health care in our African-American communities and our urban areas as well as our rural areas around the United States. But race shouldn't play a part. If, in fact, that these students are not in a hospital that is up to standards, that is up to par, that is up to a medically and board-certified standard, then I think it should shut its doors, because then what are you going to do if you're training people that have improper access to equipment? In other words, if they're using faulty equipment or if they're using equipments that aren't up to standards, that's what concerns me.
Walter, is this lawsuit the right way to go about fixing this problem?
I think it's their only recourse. You know, I followed this story for some time in the LA Times, and they did an incredible job, and it's a really tragic story. I think you have to separate issues of care from financial management. And what I'm concerned about, as the only teaching hospital teaching black practitioners on the West Coast, that you cut off that needed supply, because our community, there's still an issue of access to primary care. And I think it's critically important for the university to have a relationship with a teaching hospital, but a teaching hospital that is within the community of the population that looks like the residents in that university. So I would hope that there is some middle ground here that allows the university to restore a relationship with the hospital, because I think if you, Julianne, talked about the origins of this hospital, it was put there to serve a purpose. And then if now you're cutting off that pipeline of Black medical practitioners who can practice in that community and serve that community, we've got a serious problem. And I think the audit, while it showed financial mismanagement, from what I remember from reading the LA Times series, there weren't many questions raised about quality of care.
Actually, Walter, there were, unfortunately.
Okay.
I mean,
yes,
the unfortunate thing is that malpractice insurance, the amount of money that was paid out of Kennedy Drew for malpractice in a four-year period was $20 million. The closest hospital, the UCLA Harbor Hospital, $11 million, similar size, similar budget. Just about every indicator showed that there were care-related issues. There was also an issue in that community as the demographic was changing, that there was not enough Spanish language access. But here's the thing. The bigger issue is that there was enormous overcrowding, which is a function of being located in an inner city area where people are getting their primary health care in the emergency room. But my analysis is that three things are happening here. One is civil service rigidity. People couldn't fire anybody. So you had one man who was like an emergency room tech at night and in rehab, in one of these halfway house during the day. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not sure that I want him sewing me up, you know, for the record. You had civil service rigidity. You had some incompetence, but you also had the issue of race. In other words, that's all they deserve. And you had a county board of supervisors who sat on it. Good people, James Hahn, who was a champion initially, not moving aggressively when he was alive. When you saw, they began to get complaints in 1977, 5 years after the hospital opened. Yvonne Brathwaite-Burke, known as a conciliator. I don't know if you need a conciliator when a hospital is spiraling down.
Well, one thing I would do, though, is be careful about tying the issue of malpractice claims and care. You know, I was the former director of public affairs for the New York trial lawyers, so malpractice litigation is something that I do know something about.
But
and
you
I
know,
think,
the homies did not have good lawyers,
well,
so there had to be some.
But some of it is also driven by other factors. And I think the tragedy here is that the hospital was providing a level of care that would not have been provided had not that hospital been there.
That's questionable. I mean, the hospital's nickname was Killer King. Okay? I mean, that's the nickname that people refer to in the reputable newspapers. I'm not, you know, I think it's a mixed piece, and I'm sorry the hospital isn't there, and I think a lot of people are, you know, to blame for this. But I think the bottom line in terms of the school is that the county did the school wrong. There could have been something transitional so that those medical residents, who we will desperately need, those African-American Latino medical residents were able to have some other training function for themselves as their careers are moving.
All right, we're going to have to wrap this topic up. It's obviously one generating a lot of heat, and it's healthcare, a huge issue. In case you're just tuning in, this is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We were last listening to Julianne Malvo, president and CEO of Last Word Productions Incorporated, political consultant Walter Fields, and Ron Christie, VP of the lobbying firm DC Navigators and former special assistant to President George W. Bush. Want to move on to the Walgreens company. EEOC, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, is suing the drugstore retailer, claiming that it assigned employees to locations according to race, denying them promotions for the same reason. They investigated a complaint in Florida. And so now we have, after many different sort of class action suits, Coca-Cola recently made some moves to really deal with its own diversity issues. A big, big issue with Walgreens. Now, how much damage do you think, Ron, that this suit does?
I think it does a lot of damage. It would be one thing if this was an isolated incident with Walgreens and allegations of discrimination. As a lawyer, I can tell you, not knowing what all the facts are, I don't want to make any sweeping pronouncements, but this troubles me. You have the EEOC office in St. Louis. You have the EEOC office in Miami looking at the assignment of individuals, and apparently it's being done so based solely on the color of their race and the color of their skin, I should say. And the EEOC tried to get a settlement. They tried to work voluntarily with Walgreens. They were unable to reach an agreement with them. And so they had to file suit under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. So I think that this is a very troubling allegation. It's a very troubling seeming pattern with this particular drugstore. And I hope that we get all the facts out and that a situation is reached that if, in fact, that there has been systematic racism or systematic discrimination, that this company and its employees are held fully responsible.
Julianne, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the government's role in this. In some cases, there are class action lawsuits that are brought directly by employees. This is a government action. Is that something that is surprising, encouraging?
Well, it's interesting, Farai, because there is also a class action lawsuit that individual African-American employees have brought together without EEOC. EEOC's job is to conciliate. And coming out of this conservative administration, frankly, with all the rhetoric about race neutrality, you have to conclude that Walgreens has been pretty bad off to get EEOC to file. EEOC does not do this often. I mean, they will investigate. They will also attempt to get you to do some settlement. Often you'll hear that, you know, people are getting some small sum and that some programs are being instituted. And that is usually by EEOC urging. So when the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, with the majority of its commissioners having been appointed by a conservative Republican administration, says we're going to go ahead with this discrimination lawsuit, I would say this is one case where the fire preceded the smoke.
Walter?
No, it had to be bad. I mean, I was shocked because there's been a drought at the EEOC for some time now, and this goes back to the Reagan administration, which gutted the EEOC, and our friend Justice Thomas was leading efforts there. So I think that we must have a case of, you know, extreme situations when you have them pursuing this matter against Walgreens. And I think it's a breath of fresh air because, quite frankly, across the country, there are cases of discrimination in the workplace that do not receive fair hearing in our courts. The courts have been hostile to employment discrimination suits. So I think it's great that the federal agency responsible for this is stepping up to the plate on a situation with a company that has, you know, national implications.
I want to move on to one last topic, getting huge amount of play. Yesterday, Congress held hearings on what some might call credit card abuse. With consumers crunched by debt, the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations is looking into complaints of unjustified fees and penalties on credit card bills. Senator Carl Levin is chairman of the subcommittee, and he says credit card companies need to lighten up.
Stop charging consumers a fee to pay their bills and stop imposing abusive fees and excessive penalty interest rates. As one Michigan businessman expressed it to the subcommittee, I don't blame the credit card issuers for putting me into debt, but I do blame them for keeping me there.
Now, there are other studies and figures showing that Americans are actually spending more money than they make, so it's not really a surprise that people are in credit card debt. But should it be illegal to pursue some of the strategies that credit card companies have in order to put additional fines and to raise interest rates at will? Julianne, you're an economist. What do you think?
I think that Levin is right on the money here. This is an absurd situation for riots. You know, everybody who's in business is entitled to make a profit, but this is where you have literally usury. In addition to people paying some 30% interest if they've missed a payment or two, then you have a $25 to $50 late fee that will be imposed time and time and time again. That's how the gentleman in question who was testifying got into trouble. Then you've got this thing called a universal default clause, which means, okay, I pay my American Express bill on time every month, but I don't pay Visa on time. So Visa, American Express accesses me through Visa, and now they say, I'm going to charge you more money. So the universal default clause says one credit problem with one isolated company can wreck my entire payment schedule with every company. Again, credit card companies bear some culpability here. For right, in 2004, 4 billion credit card solicitations went out. There are 300 million Americans. The average person got 8 credit card solicitations. You know, teenagers get them. College students get them. And of course, then they get the card and then they use it. That's why they get it. And then we pass this bankruptcy legislation that makes it more difficult for people to declare bankruptcy. We prioritize the repayment of credit cards over the payment of child support. So Levin was right on time to bring these people in and to at least let them know that people are watching. The laws vary state by state about percentage of interest, but no one has begun to regulate all these late and ancillary fees. And that's something I think that's legitimate for the Congress and state legislatures to look at.
Walter, though, in business, isn't it really, as the phrase goes, what the market will bear?
No, because this is the equivalent of piling on in sandlot football, where someone is tackled and then you get 30 other people to jump on the pile. This is what credit card companies do. They just pile on and they pile on these fees. And as someone who ran a business for 11 years, I will tell you, dealing with them is extremely difficult. Because first of all, you can't understand the terms of the contract. If you read the terms of your credit card, you can get someone who is an expert in contract law.
I've had
law.
Like 5 pages show up. It's like, we've made a change.
You can't read it.
What does it mean? Does it mean? Tell me in English what it means.
And I think Julianne makes a point in terms of the aggressiveness of marketing of credit card companies. My daughter is 8, and she's received mail from credit card companies. It's ludicrous what's happening out here in terms of they reel you in, they suck you in, you get the card, and you make payments. But then you can even pay off your credit card, and they will charge you a fee based upon the balance that you were paid off. It is absolutely ridiculous, and finally Congress it looks like they're going to do something about it.
Ron, we'll end with you on that point. Is there an appetite in Congress, in the government, to make some changes in the law?
Well, I think there is an appetite to have oversight hearings, which, as Walter said, it seems to me this is long overdue. But these credit card companies have been piling on year after year. They make a lot of money. I don't begrudge anybody who works hard for making a profit. But for having been one who in college got a lot of those solicitation letters, applied for the cards, used the cards, ran up a lot of debt, and then you start paying off the debt and you still get charged interest fees, from a personal standpoint, I can tell you, enough is enough. These guys need to be held accountable. And those small little teeny tiny pieces of paper that you get with your credit card statement, you need a magnifying glass to read it. You still can't understand it, and they're just making money hand over fist. Enough is enough.
All right. On that note, we've got to end here. Ron Christie, vice president of the lobbying firm DC Navigators and former special assistant to President George W. Bush. He's here with me at NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. And political consultant Walter Fields and economist and author Julianne Malveaux, the president and CEO of Last Word Productions Incorporated, was at New York. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Farai.
Thank you.
Next on News and Notes, I chat with NPR's Juan Williams on this week's Political Corner. And the title of the new book by author Ron Stodgill says it all, Redbone, Money, Malice, and Murder in Atlanta.